This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 5th of July 2019. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 5th of July, which this week have been edited by Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent. Your readers today are Tessa Hill.
Hello.
Nora York.
Hello.
And Andrew Parkinson.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. Now, the main headlines this week: Molly's Den collapses, planners reject plan for power station, and call for charter to protect Highgate from abuse. So, Tessa, maybe have the story behind the first headline, please.
The troubled Molly's Den vintage emporium chain has gone bust with 26 people losing their jobs. Yesterday, the Winchester branch in Eastern Lane, where independent traders rent stalls to sell vintage, retro and antique goods, was shuttered and empty, less than 24 hours after traders started to receive the news. The news comes less than 2 months after the former company director, John East Rigby, died at his New Forest home of a gunshot wound to his head. Molly's Den traders had just paid their July rent, which can be up to £500 a month for the largest pitches, before news of the closure came. One trader had claimed that the month's collective rent for the three Molly's Den stores, there are two branches in Dorset, could be as much as £50,000. A trader at the Winchester Molly's Den, who asked not to be named, said, "I got a phone call yesterday at 4:15 p.m. saying what had happened. So I contacted the manager later on, and he said that the administrators or liquidators just went in and changed the locks on the doors and made them all redundant. He had just paid his share of a £525 a month stall fee and calculates that if he loses the money from sales already made, he will be more than £1,000 out of pocket. Some traders have complained that the first they knew of the closures were on social media. Writing on the Bournemouth Molly's Den Facebook page, Louise Brigden said, "We've all just paid our month's rent up front and we're only 3 days in. Plus, any sales we've made, and not so much as an email from them. What if you don't do social media?" Other traders did receive an email from LP Proudly Associates, which had been appointed to sell the enterprise. They said the company had ceased trading and would shortly be entering into liquidation. Another poster said Molly's Den, whose company director is listed at Company's House as Cherry Ann East Rigby, who lives near Ringwood, as greedy and just absolutely disgusting. Liquidators RSM Restructuring Advisory said it had been instructed to assist in placing MD Emporium, the company which owns the Molly's Den brand, into liquidation. Trading at all of the company's sites in Winchester, Bournemouth and Christchurch ceased on July the 2nd, 2019, with all 26 staff having to be made redundant, they said, adding that their agents, Proudly Associates of Ringwood, were liaising with traders in order to have their goods collected.
Planners reject plans for power station. Power station proposals saw more than 400 objections have been rejected by city council planners following civic chiefs declaring a climate emergency. The news comes after plans were submitted last summer to build a gas-powered facility on land next to Locks Farm in Botley Road, Bishop's Waltham, that would have acted as a standby facility for the next 25 years. However, it proved hugely controversial, with 412 letters of objection compared to just 2 letters of support. Meon Valley MP George Hollingbury also said he had deep concerns over the accuracy of some data submitted by agents Enzygo. He added, They raise the particular worries about the accuracy of the noise assessment. The process of acoustic testing in this case has clearly been flawed. Outlining his reasons for refusal, Council Planning Officer Robert Green said in a report, "There is no justification for the use of this countryside site for this purpose, and furthermore, it has been demonstrated that the development would be harmful to human health and well-being." Central to this are the harmful inaccuracies and uncertainty regarding the noise and air quality assessments. The council has declared a climate emergency and the development would be contrary to the council's aims over climate change. Bishop Waltham's parish council added, "The proposal would The proposal would likely result in unacceptable pollution, resulting in adverse health or quality of life impacts." Reacting to the refusal, Facebook group Bishops Waltham Against Power Station posted, "The developer made no attempt to engage any of the local residents or community in their plans. There has also been overwhelming support from the community in terms of writing letters, providing contacts to experts and attending meetings, helping with the publicity and contributing to the funding to pay for some of the expert reports. Unfortunately, this may not be the end. The developer has the right to take the case to the Secretary of State with an appeal. We hope that we have provided overwhelming evidence why this power station in this locality is absolutely wrong." And there is a picture of, it's a map, a Google map, of the area that they were considering.
And this week's third headline is Call for Charter to Protect Hyde Gate from Abuse. Recent graffiti on stonework in Hyde Abbey Gate has prompted local resident Edward Graffeno to invite public support for a protective charter for the monument. "Over the recent years, we have become used, sadly, to all types of rubbish, drug users' paraphernalia, and smashed bottles littering the historic gateway," said Mr. Fennell. "But graffiti on the walls, especially of a rather sinister kind, which damages the fabric of the building, is a step too far. The time has come for local people to stand up and demand protection of this site of national heritage significance." The graffiti appeared last Friday and seems to be a message of some kind, possibly directed at those who do drug deals in the gateway. It says, "London Dave, 28th of June 2019, back for the future," and is accompanied by a snake image. Mr. Fennell acknowledges the difficulties of policing the area, which has required a reputation for drug abuse. However, he says that the proposed six-point charter could be the starting point for both cleaning up the locality and giving Hyde Gate the status it deserves as a key site in the story of King Alfred, who was buried nearby within Hyde Abbey Garden. "The more neglected the gate is, the more it will be abused. This is simply not good enough for such an important heritage hub." Mr. Fennell is now inviting local people to support the charter, which exhorts Winchester City and Hampshire County Councils to undertake, first, improved maintenance of the gate so as to ensure it is litter-free and clean. Next, the installation of CCTV so as to deter criminal activity. The laying of a new hard-wearing non-trip floor surface. The installation of additional displays which interpret the history of Hyde Abbey. The reordering of the adjacent chamber so that the current historical architectural features on display can be properly exhibited. And finally, the installation of equipment to facilitate light projections within the gateway and chamber. And the article is accompanied by a couple of photographs, one showing the graffiti and the other a rather nice photograph of the Hyde Abbey Gate.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements and then Christian comment, letters to the editor, historical items, chronicle comment, first person and Belgarum. And then we'll do the announcements and what's on. So we start with the death announcements this week. Baron, Mary Baron, who died peacefully on the 24th of June, aged 95. Brewer, John Anthony Brewer, died peacefully on the 1st of June, aged 84. Cleaver, Brian Cleaver, died quietly at home after a short illness, aged 84. Ellsworthy, Elizabeth Jane Ellsworthy, died peacefully on the 26th of June, aged 71. Gerard, Sybil Irene Gerard, died on the 29th of June, aged 85. Green, Tim Green, died suddenly on the 13th of June, aged 50. Holland, John Austin Holland, died at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital on the 27th of June, aged 89. Leask, John Leask, died at home on the 30th of June, aged 83. Meller, Brian Meller, died on the 23rd of June, aged 75. Morrison, Alfred John Morrison, died peacefully on the 19th of June. Russell, Hazel Elizabeth Russell, died on the 25th of June after a short illness, aged 80. Slade, Rosemary Slade, died peacefully on the 23rd of June, aged 72. Smith, Roger Leslie Smith, died peacefully on the 23rd of June. Tostevine, Dorothy Tostevine, died peacefully at Oak Ridge House Nursing Home, aged 81. Twine, Brian Arthur Twine, died on the 24th of June, aged 76. Warren, John Frederick Warren, died on the 25th of June, aged 83. White, Janet Elizabeth White, died peacefully at home on the 24th of June, aged 65. And Wilson, Pamela Mary Wilson, died peacefully at home on the 22nd of June, aged 82. And now, Andrew, I think you have Christian comment, please.
This week's Christian comment is written by Rosemary Baker, and it's titled The Power of Stories. Well, dear reader, I wonder if you're going to notice a difference. I have completed the three workshops I signed up for on getting started as a writer at my local library. Before my retirement, when people asked if I had any plans for occupying my time, I replied, maybe try my hand at writing. I think many people imagine some sort of James Herriot equivalent for my working life as a psychiatrist, and of course that remains a possibility. I, though, imagine myself retelling some of my father's children's stories for the next generation. Some time and an eventual move with a lot of stuff, still in storage later, it began to look as if my retirement would be spent sorting the stuff out for years to come. A talk to the Women's Fellowship in King Somborne on my friend's parents' war memorabilia led me to think I might write on various interesting finds discovered in the layers of excavation involved in the decanting and emptying of our previous home. Quite a few of my fellow would-be writers were, or indeed had, wanted to write their own family history. However, the course was planned to be quite general and quite literally just get us started with suggestions of where we might seek publication, beginning with very short articles for magazines and online sites. We began with writing about an experience. I was told my attempt was too factual as it was writing a report and lacking any emotional content, hardly surprising considering my job. Well, if I had known what was required, however, by the time of my last attempt, I was judged to have made enormous progress, just in time to fill in the feedback form. Amazing. I recently read an article in a magazine on preaching that suggested if one could no longer take the pulpit for health reasons, then one should write. Of course, some newspaper editors might not be so keen on being inundated, but I dare say they are selective about what letters they publish. Perhaps it was intended that they should write to fellow Christians or those struggling with their faith. This reminded me of St. Paul and his letters. It is said, or he is said, to have written 13 of the 27 letters in the New Testament, although only 7 are undisputed. The others may be by some of his followers. Some were written whilst he was in prison, intended to give him guidance and encouragement to new churches and Christians in Asia Minor. A new president and vice president of the Methodist Church have just been inducted at this year's Methodist Conference. The theme they have chosen for their story, or this year, is What's the Story? The Christian Church is rediscovering the power of testimony and story.
Thank you. Now we move on to letters to the editor. Tessa, you have the first.
The first letter comes from John Seeger Green, headlined Decision Stinks. Sir, over the years one has become inured to the cathedral's surprising, to be polite, decisions, but I think we have reached the nadir. On the newly grown post-Christmas market grass in the inner close, in the centre of the south side of the cathedral's nave, directly outside the south door, a row of portaloos has been placed not modestly against a side wall, but flagrantly right in the centre of one of the finer views of the cathedral. What kind of a Philistine made such a decision, and why has such an exemplar of bad taste and lack of judgment been allowed to remain? What sort of person would make such a decision? I ask myself, followed only by the question, why is that person on the cathedral's payroll? John Seeger Green, the Hospital of St. Cross, Winchester.
And this one is Pavilion Like Badly Stacked Pallets. And this is from Michelle Juggins, Nee Scott. Sir, why is the proposed new pavilion for the North Walls Recreation Ground such a horrendous, ugly affair? Why can't it be designed on more traditional, attractive lines instead of awkward angles and jarring, migraine-inducing wooden cladding? Please send whoever is responsible for designing this monstrosity on a tour of all the beautiful buildings this country has to offer. Maybe then they would design something that doesn't look like a load of badly stacked pallets. And that was from Michelle Juggins, Nee Scott of Main Road, Ossulbury. And there is a picture, an artist's impression, of the new pavilion. And it is migraine, it's inconducing, cladded. And it is all angles and windows at weird places. No, not attractive.
Changing gear a little bit, this letter is called Student Housing. Sir, many friends who reside on the Stanmore and Winall estates were heartened when student accommodation was under construction at the Winchester University and elsewhere. Having seen the full-page advertisement in the Hampshire Chronicle, page 28, June 13, I was surprised to say the least. However, a chance chat with a student I know quite well has been an eye-opener. The student in question, from a middle-class family, told me that the student lets were beyond his means and he was going to rent in Stanmore. Further to that, it was stated that it was generally students of wealthy families from abroad who could afford the rooms on offer. Given the facilities on offer in the advertisement, including 1,800 bedrooms for hire, can this be right? And that's from Mr. E.J. Smith, Takedown Meads, Winchester.
Our next letter is titled Responsibilities. Sir, At a time when butterflies, bees and insects are under increasing threat, I was astonished to see that the field beside the railway line, known as the allotment field, and part of the bushfield area, has been savagely cleared. This means that a huge swathe of rose bay, willow herb and goldenrod has been lost as a valuable habitat for all manner of wildlife at an important time in their life cycles. In addition, large stands of common spotted orchid were mown down in full bloom. The landowner, the church, continues to take no care of the environment in the bushfield area and has shown by his latest mindless clearance a complete disregard for our current environmental crisis. There are saplings that have grown up on this unused ground and need to be cleared at some point as part of general management of the land, but that could easily have been done in the autumn. This is from Barbara Guthrie, Stanmore Lane, Winchester.
And Karen McCleary writes about her history lessons. Sir, I was incredibly privileged a few weeks ago to travel with the Royal British Legion veterans back to the Normandy beaches to commemorate the D-Day landings 75 years ago. Listening as those elderly gentlemen told of their horrific wartime experiences, fighting to overcome German forces and restore democracy to an occupied Europe. I was again made aware of just how lucky we were in this country not to have been invaded during the dark days of 1940 when under serious threat. Equally telling on my recent trip were the civilian stories of French citizens of cities such as Le Havre and Caen, who saw their cities occupied by foreign forces and then nearly bombed into oblivion as the Allies fought to gain a foothold in occupied France. Britain is one of the oldest democracies in the world, and our history tells us to ignore democracy at our peril and stand up to those who seek to ride roughshod over the rights and freedoms hard won over centuries. Winston Churchill said, "Those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it." It should cause grave concern, therefore, when politicians seek to overturn properly constructed democratic decisions, and I winced when I read Chancellor Paula Ferguson of the Liberal Democrats saying she is standing as an MP because she wants to stop Brexit, chronicled June 27th. I remind her and her party, ironically with the word Democrat in its title, that the European referendum vote to exit the EU was the biggest supported vote this country has ever had, and the majority of the electorate voted to leave the EU. Politicians of all colours should respect the wishes of the people and remember the lessons of history. And that was from Karen McCleary, Hook Pit Farm Lane, Kingsworthy.
This letter is from the Chief Executive Kidscape and is talking about the pressure on children. Sir, as schools approach the end of the summer term, thousands of children across the country will be preparing to move from primary to secondary school. This should be an exciting time. But recent research shows the pressure facing children making that transition is greater than ever. Over a third, nearly 40%, of 11-year-olds feel anxious about starting secondary school in September, and 40% say that bullying is their main concern. It's obvious there is a need to do more for children as they make the move, which is why we are launching our RISE workshops in partnership with West Ham and Bassett and Gold. Delivered across England and Wales, the workshops will help children to manage change, make friends, and stand up against bullying. Anxiety can stop children from getting the good start they need and have a devastating impact on their educational attainment. It is vital children are fully equipped to move up to secondary school with confidence and go on to reach their full potential. And that letter is from Lauren Seeger-Smith, who's the Chief Executive of Kidscape, Grosvenor Gardens, Belgravia, London.
Our next letter is titled Lifestyle Change. Sir, Terence Wall, in the Chronicle Letters of June the 20th, makes some valid points about the polluting influence of humanity on planet Earth, but he seems to suggest that the reality of climate change has yet to be demonstrated. The scientific evidence that climate change is and has been happening over recent decades is overwhelming, and this is accepted by almost all national governments. Practically any newspaper or news broadcast now reports record-breaking weather or other extreme events, floods, wildfires, storms, etc., somewhere in the world on an almost daily basis. It is true that the Earth's climate has fluctuated in the past, but apparently this has never been so fast as is happening today. Today, atmospheric levels of the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide are around one-third greater than they have been for at least the last 140,000 years, as measured in Antarctic ice cores, and the rate of increase is rising. There is also a strong correlation between the amount of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere and global warming. Global warming since the mid-20th century can only be explained quantitatively if the huge amounts of carbon dioxide emitted from burning fossil fuels are included in the calculations. Researchers, scientists and engineers are already investigating what urgently needs to be done to counter climate change. In many instances, the technical means already exist. For example, renewable energy must replace fossil fuels, but barriers to action exist in people's, and not least in politicians' minds. Consuming less is certainly important, but it can only be part of the solution. It is very clear that we also have to use forms of road transport which are much less polluting, and this includes walking and cycling. Electric bikes are very efficient too. We must highly insulate all existing buildings and ensure that absolutely all new homes and offices are built to the highest standards so that heating and cooling are reduced to almost zero. We need to start doing this today. This is from Bob Whitmarsh, Berwick Avenue, Winchester.
And this letter is titled An Epidemic, and it's from Jeff Naylor. Sir, in a press release, the chief executive of the UK's Gambling Commission, Neil MacArthur, said, "I want gambling consumers in Britain to be able to enjoy the fairest and safest gambling in the world." Also, he has revealed in a radio interview that there are over 23 million gamblers in the UK. "I cannot believe that over a third of the population are willingly partaking in purported leisure activity in which they lose money. It sounds to me that the UK now has an epidemic of addiction. Gambling is certainly not fair or safe. Unscrupulous operators exploit the natural tendency of humans towards addictive behaviour to feather their own nests. Everyone is susceptible to this sort of psychological dependency, but especially children. The government should step in for the good of all and treat this crisis as both a national mental health and social emergency." And that was from Jeff Naylor, Birch Close, Colden Common.
Post-Brexit trade. Sir, there is every reason to be excited about becoming a free trading nation when we have left the EU. We have a fixation on the mayhem that may arise at Dover or the tunnel as we leave the EU without being aware of the volume of world trade that is passing up and down the channel, mostly to Rotterdam and increasingly to Southampton or Felixstowe. Just one container ship of 21,000 TEU capacity, that's the 20-foot equivalent units, is more likely to hold over 10,000 40-foot containers that would make up 70 trains, each over 1 mile long. How many such beasts are en route every day? Let's get our focus on the big picture, not the M20 lorry park. UK Limited is well placed to become the entrepot for world trade to Europe, because free port customs arrangements will enable the transference of goods to lesser vessels or rail in places like Southampton, where there is deep water, a sheltered and short approach, double high tide, and rail links which have had either the trackbed lowered or bridges raised, or both, to enable high-speed container freight to proceed direct to the required destination. The Hong Kong of Europe? Question. That's exciting. Rotterdam ranks third in the world after Singapore and Shanghai and has fantastic facilities and excellent onward transportation, but its Achilles heel is the long, slow approach being made progressively worse by draft and speed restrictions, and not invariably by also being fog-bound. Big ships cause wake, they also pollute, hence the ever-increasing strictures. Southampton is fast becoming a favoured drop point, even for the continent, as it is west of Beachy Head where pilotage, speed constraints, restricted channels and congestion starts. If you do not think Southampton has enough acreage or wharfs just yet, then think in terms of dynamically positioned floating cranes, the old Mulberry harbours, and exchange goods in the Solent. That's how Hong Kong got rich. The EU might be encouraged to facilitate a free trade arrangement because it's their goods, both imports and exports, that are most affected. And that letter is from Mark Masterman of Scott's Paddock, Meanstoke.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. And now we're going to take a step back in time. I think Tessa's going to take us back 100 years to start with.
100 years ago, on Saturday, July the 15th, 1919, under the head The City of Winchester and Its Part in the War, Mr. E. Holdaway has compiled a record of the troops quartered in the City of Winchester and its camps from August 1914 to the present time. Tabulated under a different head, Mr. Holdaway has succeeded in tracing the names of some 250 regiments of units of the British and Dominion troops and those of our allies who have been quartered in Winchester for longer or shorter periods during the past 5 years. The whole of the services at Winchester Cathedral tomorrow will be special in character. The military service at 9:25 in the morning is to be one of thanksgiving and will be attended by representatives of all branches of the troops quartered in Winchester and its immediate neighbourhood. A collection will be made at the close of the service in aid of the funds of St Dunstan's Hostel for blinded soldiers and sailors.
And 50 years ago today, Saturday, July the 5th, 1969, there are two articles. The council and headmistress of St Swithin's School are cautiously optimistic about the future, despite the difficulties that the girls' boarding schools face at the present time. At the annual speech day on Saturday, Miss P.M.C. Evans, headmistress, said, "I am rather more confident about our future now than I was before the Public Schools Commission report was published." She added, "Of course, we know that independent schools can only survive as long as the parents want to send children to them. Our continuance, in fact, depends on our publicity agents, and by this I mean everyone here. Parents tell other parents that they like the school. People meet girls who have been here or are still here, and they like and approve of what they see and hear, or they don't. I'm glad to say that I gather from comments made by people when they first come to see the school that on the whole they do." And the second item, signatures from local residents and overseas visitors have been amassing during the past 2 weeks under a petition in the entrance hall of the God Begot Hotel and Restaurant behind Winchester High Street. The petition reads, "Application has been made by Bernfeld Brothers Limited to convert the whole of this building into a jeweller's shop. We earnestly request all our guests and lovers of this fine building to resist this takeover by signing this petition. Next Monday, the completed petition will be handed in for consideration by the City Council's Planning Committee, who will have before them a plan to extend the present shopfront on the High Street to incorporate the remainder of the Godbegot building, including its 16th century dining room.
And we have two articles from 25 years ago, Friday the 1st of July 1994. The completion of building work on two car parks at Bar End in August will finally allow Winchester's long-awaited pilot park and ride scheme to begin on September the 19th. City and county councillors at the Winchester Movement and Access Plan Joint Members Panel last Friday heard the latest progress report on the controversial scheme and its associated city centre traffic management proposals. Builders Dyer and Butler will complete the £920,000 contract by the end of August, providing 333 car parking spaces at St Catherine's View and Barfield Close. According to a report from both city and county traffic officers, the Hampshire Bus Company will provide high-quality vehicles with a distinctive livery, which will travel to and from the city centre between 7:30 in the morning and 6:30 at night at 10 minutes frequency in peak time and 15 minutes off-peak. The county will give the city £47,160 to run the two Bar End car parks, and security will be an important element of the management. The sites will be patrolled by attendants and will have closed-circuit television. A marketing company, EQ's, has been appointed to publicise the September launch. City Council Chief Parking Officer Ron Lambert confirmed that the season ticket prices for long-stay car parks would go up as an incentive to commuters to switch to park and ride. The second article is, the Home Office has given its backing to use of a former Winchester Bail Hostel as a permanent night shelter. The plans for Carlisle House in St Thomas Street are supported by Winchester and Alton MP, Jerry Malone, but they have met with opposition from city residents. The building is owned by Hampshire Probation Service and therefore comes under the aegis of the Home Office, which had originally rejected the idea. But following an appeal from Chairman of Winchester Church's night shelter, Jeremy Ouvray, Mr. Malone wrote to the Home Office Minister, David McLean, asking him to re-examine the case, and the Home Office reversed its decision. The application was due to be considered by Winchester City Council's Planning Committee yesterday, that is Thursday. Meanwhile, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Cogan, who lives two doors away from Carlisle House, has given his backing to the proposals. There is obviously a need for this, and it seems to me a great pity that this house could remain vacant, he said. As to the views of other Winchester residents, who are not enamoured by the idea, he added, I think we, who are privileged to live in security and in peace, should go out and meet these people in their need.
Thank you. Now back to the present, and we have editorial chronicle comment, please, Tessa.
This comment is about climate solution, headed Climate Solution Still Some Way Off, It Seems. No doubt the residents of Bishop's Waltham will be breathing a sigh of relief this week after planners threw out a scheme for a standby gas-powered power station in the countryside. Alongside questions over the accuracy of the planning documents submitted, the officer in the case made it clear the proposal could not be approved as it did not help in the noble mission to tackle climate change. Some called for greener alternatives to provide the much-needed energy to support modern, technology-obsessed life. So would residents really back wind turbines, for example, blotting their rural view? History suggests not. Unfortunately, NIMBYism comes into play, along with the priority to preserve house prices. If we are serious about getting a grip on the crisis jeopardising humanity's future, rather than simply sounding good and declaring climate emergencies, we have to accept these alternatives to smoke-belching coal power stations for our energy. Hopefully, these news pages will one day be filled with positive solutions being approved by planners.
Thank you. Now we have first person, Norma.
And George Hayter writes, I can't stand neighbour noise. We feel we have to creep quietly around our home after about 10:30 p.m. My wife and I don't want to disturb the people in the flat below. Perhaps it's a bit extreme, but we know our footsteps can be heard below because we can hear the footsteps in the flat above. I hadn't appreciated how noisy flats are, even without having Boris Johnson as a neighbour. For 26 years before moving into this flat, I lived in houses and was never disturbed. Now I'm woken every weekday morning by the lady upstairs walking from room to room as she prepares to leave for work. Sounds of drawers and cupboards opening and closing continue until finally I hear a key in her door, followed by receding footsteps on the communal stairs. Recently, a friend of mine mentioned the annoyance caused by a vibrating phone in the flat above his. He told me it made him reach to answer his own phone. Various other flat owners have told me they hear arguments, stereos, children and dogs. Annoying sound is a widespread cause of misery. Researchers say that on, off or varying noises are particularly hard for humans to adapt to. The government agrees that noise is a problem. It hopes take action against noisy road vehicles. Over the next 6 months, the Department of Transport is testing automatic noise cameras, rather like speed traps. They should be able to detect revving boy racers and roaring bikers and instantly photograph their number plates and for fines to be posted. Perhaps the authorities should also try to cut noise from neighbours in flats. We need to make flats more attractive to home seekers to reduce global warming. Huddled together in single building, flats inherently waste less heat than detached houses, and flats facilitate denser populations than wasteful houses, which eat up land and dictate longer commutes, more roads and more polluting travel. For some people, earplugs might be an answer to the inter-flat noise, but they're not a full-time solution for anyone who likes conversation or hearing their phone ringing. Another strategy is persuading everyone to be quiet, though an authoritarian publicity campaign for widespread hush would lead to a loud civil liberties protest. Surely the eventual solution will be architectural. Britain has to strengthen the regulations for flat construction. We need to invest in future peace and quiet while requiring thicker walls and ceilings, which should have a compound structure that includes a layer of wadding. Windows and doors should be weighty and fringed with a sound-absorbing spongy seal. Low-frequency bass sounds is hard to stop, so concrete, brick and or similar should be always featured in the multi-material barrier between dwellings. Owners of existing buildings should be encouraged to increase their insulation and thereby the value of their property by a system of soundproofing certification that would grade flats from very noisy to very quiet. I know all these upgrades would cost a lot. With the existing building regulations we have, the nation already struggles to provide a home for every household. So where can developers make savings to provide extra cash for quiet? Perhaps by building smaller homes. I would swap a big noisy flat for a small quiet one. I think millions of other people suffering from noisy neighbours would embrace less living space in exchange for more quiet. For people trying to moderate the behaviour of a noisy neighbour, my advice, say hello to the noisy so-and-so, make friends with him or her. Through gritted teeth, smile and laugh with them. That's what I did years ago when I was living next door to a breeder who had 20 small dogs piled up in boxes. but one day the yapping got too much for me. I shouted at him over the garden wall. After that, he saw me as an enemy and abandoned any attempt to quieten the dogs.
And now an alternative look at the news from Belgarum. The first article is accompanied by a new road sign that's being introduced, which shows a red warning triangle with the picture of a hedgehog in it. Drivers have got used to the warning signs alerting us to the possibility of deer on the roads or ponies in the New Forest, and in the spring of migrating toads. Soon there will be another. The red framed triangle will frame an image of a hedgehog. It's part of a national initiative to highlight the dangers to smaller mammals such as hedgehogs, rabbits and badgers. Transport Secretary Chris Grayling said, "We have some of the safest roads in the world, but we are always looking at how we can make them safer. Motorcyclists and other vulnerable road users are particularly at risk. The new small mammal warning sign will help to reduce the number of people killed and injured, as well as help our precious small wild mammal population to flourish." The second one is accompanied by a charming picture of a flower-rich verge by the River Itchen on Water Lane. It's called Flowers on the River Bank. Perhaps this is one of the few examples where local government cost-cutting has been beneficial. In the past, the verge by the River Itchen would have been rigorously cut several times a summer. Now, the area between the footpath and the river, just north of City Mill, has been sown with wild flower seed and left to its own devices, attracting bees and other beneficial insects. Once the flowers die down later in the summer, some may feel the area will look untidy, but for now, Belgarum thinks it looks rather lovely. And I would comment personally that there are a couple of roundabouts, one in Otterbourne and one down at Eastleigh, where they've used the same technique, and they are looking absolutely glorious at the moment. A complete swathe of lots and lots of different colours. So I do hope they don't cut them down and they leave the seeds or the plants to self-seed for the following season. The third comment is TV spotlight on City Jail. Winchester Prison is preparing for a documentary to be shown on Channel 4 in the autumn, looking at criminal justice in Hampshire. The first three episodes are expected to focus heavily on the prison in early 2018 when it was put into special measures. It captures a time when the prison was very chaotic and unstable. On his arrival in September, Governor Jim Bourke outlined a strategy for the prison to focus on the basics, in increasing stability in the prison and improving safety to become a good local prison. The strategy is to keep it real, R-E-A-L, by focusing on relationships, environment, activities and leadership. Mr. Bourke is said to be delighted by how this strategy is being praised by staff and prisoners and the speed with which this has brought stability and improved safety for prisoners and staff. The governor said, "Winchester really is a wonderful place to live and work, and we are so grateful to the local community for their practical support in all that we are looking to achieve."
Thank you. Now we have the announcements, and we start with what's on. Firstly, there's a concert on Saturday the 13th of July at 2:30 p.m. It's a concert of classical clarinet music performed by Emma Alexandra and the City of London Chamber Players. It's at St Lawrence's Church in the Square, and you can get tickets on the door. Secondly, just a reminder for the next week, we have two festivals on. The Botley Music Festival, which runs from Sunday through till Saturday, July the 13th. And that's live music in the village with a variety of musical events for all ages and musical tastes. And if you want details of the programme, you can ring 07784 283 723. That's 07784 283 723. And secondly, there's the star lineup for the Winchester Festival, which runs all next week from today when we're recording this, Friday, July the 5th, to Saturday, July the 13th. And will, as ever over its 22 years, be a cornucopia of composition, characters and culture. The full festival guide has been released, and you can obtain that from www.winchesterfestival.co.uk. But there's a packed programme of talks. Takes us from Charles Spencer's account of Charles II evading capture by Cromwell's army, to Andrew Marr's History of Modern Britain, and Simon Schammer's Contemporary Reflections on the Arts, Politics and Food. And there's concerts bringing us sacred vocal music from the Sistine Chapel, Renaissance repertoire from Spain, Portugal and the New World, and a quintessentially English evening of Elgar and Vaughan Williams in the Cathedral. The lighting up time ends Friday the 5th of July at 4:57 a.m. and begins at 9:22 p.m. And on Wednesday the 10th of July it ends at 5:02 a.m. and begins at 9:19 p.m. And if you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Mary Davis on 01962 711 998. And now we continue with items of general news. Tessa?
The headline is Wilding the Landscape event at Test Valley Farm. Ways to build a productive and biodiverse countryside is the subject of a day event at a farm near Stockbridge. The day involves a programme of farm walks and talks, barbecue and a panel discussion chaired by John Humphreys of BBC Radio 4 with guest speaker Isabella Tree, the acclaimed author of Wilding. Appropriate name. It is on Saturday, August the 10th from 3:45 p.m. into the evening at Manor Farm, home of Broughton Water Buffalo, Broughton, near Stockbridge, SO20 8AN. Organisers say the world is in a state of global climate emergency, with the natural world under threat from melting ice caps to the mass extinction of polluting bees and insects, from global warming to rising sea levels. But still, with millions of human mouths to feed, how can we reconcile the sometimes polar needs and demands of agriculture on the one hand with the sustainable ecological solutions posed on the other? Isabella Tree will open the discussion with an illustrated talk on the rewilding project undertaken by her and her husband, Charlie Burrell, at their home on the Knepp Estuary in West Sussex nearly 20 years ago. Now held as a leading light for conservation, their bold move to allow nature to take the reins has been hugely successful in reversing the cataclysmic decline in certain flora and fauna species. Joining Isabella will be two local farmers, Dagan James, who farms water buffalo on increasing wilding principles, and Craig Livingston, Farmers Weekly Farmer of the Year 2018, who manages a neighbouring mixed farm. Also with them will be Alison Cross, Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust Principal Farm Advisor. Chairing the panel and bringing to the discussion his own experience as an organic farmer is BBC Radio 4's John Humphreys. Tickets including farm walks, barbecue, glass of wine or soft drink and talk are £25. For more information and ticket purchase inquiries, please contact mail at julia-brigdale.co.uk.
And this is an article about Barbara Large, The Final Chapter. Barbara Alicia Large was born in 1932 and grew up in Vancouver, where her library-loving grandfather imbued her lifelong passion for creative writing. By the age of 16, she had started college, majoring in English literature. After postgraduate study in London during the early 1950s, Barbara met John Large on the boat home. In 1969, they returned to England with their young family, and when he became Professor of Applied Acoustics at Southampton University. The house in Shawford remained Barbara's home until her death in March. Barbara taught at such varied locations as St Swithin's School, Southampton University and Winchester Prison. She set up education programmes for inmates as Chief Education Officer at Hasler Detention Centre in the 1900s. This culminated in a secondment to the Home Office, reviewing prisoners' reading standards, for which she was awarded the MBE in 1998. Barbara's great achievement was her influence on the creative writing world. She hosted the first Winchester Writers' Conference in 1980, which blossomed as word spread of its inspirational director's kindness and generosity of spirit. However inexperienced or unconfident a writer, by the end of a frenetic weekend or more of learning and socialising, everyone left refuelled by Barbara's belief in their potential as authors. Excuse me. Moving to the University of Winchester in the early 2000s, Barbara almost single-handedly developed the conference to include national and international delegates. Each year, the keynote speech was given by an eminent friend, such was her prestige: Douglas Adams, P.D. James, Terry Pratchett, Julian Fellowes, Michael Mompergo, Jacqueline Wilson, Carol Ann Duffy, headlined over 33 years. Agents, publishers and authors buzzed around, leading workshops and mentoring individuals. Dozens of new authors successfully launched careers. Barbara retired as an honorary fellow of the university at the age of 81 and then continued to mentor and teach courses. She started the popular Hampshire Writers' Society, which continues to grow. The first memorial award in her memory has just been awarded to a protege, wheelchair-bound author Anthony Ridgway. In the autumn of 2017, Barbara was diagnosed with myeloma, but published an anecdotal cookbook, Scrumptious Recipes for a Pampered Patient, which with proceeds to the Nick Jonas Ward of the RSCH. At the 39th Winchester Writers' Festival in June, around 20 speakers recounted Barbara's dedication, the university chapel filled with laughter and love. Last Thursday, a memorial service was attended by her son John, granddaughter Dina, past Mayor of Winchester Dominic Hiscock, neighbours, friends, colleagues and fellow writers. Barbara is buried in the churchyard with her son and husband, who predeceased her in 1993 and 1998. She leaves a son and five grandchildren.
And one of the great local events, the Hat Fair, is returning for its 45th year. The streets of Winchester will be lined with singers, dancers and other entertainment acts this weekend as the UK's longest-running outdoor arts festival returns. Hat Fair 2019 will be celebrating its 45th anniversary and is expected to draw in audiences of more than 70,000 people as performers from across the world put on a show to remember. Performances, activities and installations will take place throughout the city centre on Friday and Saturday, with the festivities moving to North Wall's Recreation Ground on Sunday. Director Andrew Loretto said, "I'm particularly looking forward to work that has been specially made for the festival, including a Downs promenade along the river, a spoof history tour of Winchester, and an exploration of the beautiful Wolvesey Castle." Audiences should also look out for an enigmatic fisherman appearing high up on rooftops, spectacular dance circus at the bus station, and an explosion of colour with our opening carnival featuring hundreds of local young people. He added, "Hat Fair 2019 flies the flag for inclusivity, diversity and European internationalism. The festival starts on Friday at noon with the carnival, where hundreds of local schoolchildren will leave the Great Hall in brightly coloured costumes they have created for the event. One of last year's headline acts, Motion House, returns with a new piece called Wild, where performers will carry out daring moves across an area of poles. On Saturday night, festival goers are encouraged to get involved with a giant ceilidh hosted by the folk dance Remixed. University of Winchester students will also perform in the Top Hat competition, and last year's winner, Martin Jakeman, will make an appearance with Home Fires, inspired by Second World War stories. Brochures can be found online and can be picked up from the Winchester Tourist Information Centre or from the Theatre Royal.
And now for a little celebrity news about a TV presenter's special day. A BBC presenter selected Winchester photographers to take pictures on his wedding day. Adrian Photography, run by husband and wife Adriana and Lucien Parian, have published photos of the day when BBC's Mike Bushell tied the knot with Emily Bond. Mr. Bushell, an ex-Chronicle reporter who grew up in the city and attended King Alfred's College, now Winchester University, married earlier this summer at Oakley Hall near Basingstoke. Emily and Mike said, "We're so pleased that we chose Adriana and Lucien to capture our wedding day. They are very professional and bring so much imagination and creativity to their work. They worked tirelessly throughout the day to capture every moment, which was no easy task with over 200 guests. While Adriana was taking photos, Lucien was shooting a video, which will be published in the style of a story. Lucien said, "We were thrilled and honoured to receive the call from Mike Bushell. The wedding was absolutely stunning and a privilege to shoot. It all started with a traditional church service and continued with a joyous celebration in a beautiful setting at Oakley Hall. All went well, the weather was great, everyone was highly supportive in making sure we got the best possible shots. It's accompanied by a lovely photograph of the happy couple."
Bats, the star of the night, but in need of our help. Flitting out of the rising darkness like shadows, bats are as charismatic as they are misunderstood. Britain is home to 18 species of bats, the largest being the noctul, which weighs as little as 4 one-pound coins. The smallest, the pipistrelle, weighing as little as a 2p coin, is known to gobble up more than 500 insects in an hour. Whether you are watching them flying through the woods or skimming the river, the sight of a bat quickens the heart. Bats are most active in the summer months, when they come out of hibernation, hunt insects and give birth and raise young. And the best time to see them is around sunset or sunrise, when it's warm and dry. While some bats fly relatively high, others are found closer to the ground, not venturing far above the trees or flying low over grassland and water. To really experience the bat's world, it's worth borrowing a special detector to hear the high-frequency clicks and buzzes of bats using echolocation to hunt. Not only will you be able to hear how many bats are around you, but the frequency of the calls lets you identify them in the dark. Testwood Lakes Nature Reserve is a great place to enjoy bats, but you can also experience these beguiling creatures at home, whether it's in the countryside, town or city. All British bats eat insects, and by following a few easy steps to make your garden wildlife friendly, you might find that bats come to you. Here are some simple ways you can help bats. The first is, aim to grow as many flowers throughout the year as possible to attract a diversity of insects. Oxeye daisies, wild angelica, lavender and marjoram are popular choices that will attract a wide range of insects. 2. Avoid using pesticides and encourage natural predators instead. Predatory beetles, centipedes, hoverflies, ladybirds, lacewings and ground beetles are all gardeners' friends. they will happily move into compost heaps, log piles and rockeries and polish off all your garden pests. And the last one is you can create microhabitats by making log or leaf piles, mulching garden beds and leaving hollow stems standing over winter as bug shelters.
And here's something a little bit different. This is an artistic use for old copies of the Hampshire Chronicle. A sculpture by a local schoolgirl has been selected for a new exhibition at the Royal Academy of Arts in London, and it was made using old Hampshire Chronicle newspapers. Amelia Frost, a 12-year-old pupil at Twyford School, was one of only 139 artists chosen from more than 6,200 entrants. The Year 7 student created the chairman during the school holidays using recycled pieces of wood, chicken wire and several copies of the Chronicle, which she shredded to make paper mache. Amelia found the stool and chair at the Winchester Recycling Centre at Bar End. She said, "I feel really excited and surprised to have been chosen. I'm quite blown away and quite speechless because it's such a big achievement. I'm excited to see what the other entries look like in the exhibition and seeing how my statue will look against all of the other art." Amelia's art teacher put a foreword for the competition, and her piece was then judged by a panel of artists, RA curators and RA school students and teachers. And the chairman, which is what the statue is called, will be on display in the inaugural Young Artists Summer Show at the RA between July the 13th and August the 4th. And the piece is accompanied by a photograph of the chairman, which is a fantastic pun on a statue of a man, which I would guess to be perhaps even 6 foot high, standing, made out of, as we said, paper mache and copies of the old Hampshire Chronicle. And he's standing upright and leaning against a chair. And I think Amelia has done a fantastic job there. We'll probably be seeing more of Amelia's work in the future.
This one is about a museum talk on the Great War flying ace Cecil Lewis. The story of the last fighter ace of the First World War will be told in an illustrated talk at the Army Flying Museum. Journalist and historian Paul Beaver returns to the Middle Wallop Museum for the first time since it reopened to tell the story of the Royal Flying Corps and most notably Cecil Lewis. Cecil Lewis was a giant of a man in a time where there were many tall men. He knew George Bernard Shaw, won an Oscar, founded the BBC, wrote features for the Daily Mail, and spent his final years, lots of them, on Corfu. When he died in 1998, he was the last fighter ace of the First World War. In fact, he became an ace around his 19th birthday, and by the time he was 20, he had a military cross and more than a dozen kills. In the Second World War, he re-enlisted and returned to flying and then command. The talk, which takes place on Thursday, July the 11th, will draw from the autobiographical account Sagittarius Rising. Mr. Beaver will use the museum's own displays to tell the story of fragile aeroplanes and pilots who flew without parachutes. He will cover its creation, first actions, successes and failures, as well as why it morphed into the Royal Air Force. For tickets, call 01264 781 086.
New deacons serve Hampshire. 10 men and women joined the Diocese of Winchester's team of clergy on Sunday as they were ordained deacons at the cathedral by the Bishop of Winchester, the Right Reverend Tim Dakin. 3 women and 7 men, ranging in age from 25 to 56, have come to serve God from a variety of backgrounds, bringing in a breadth of unique experiences. Between them, they have worked in a wide range of sectors, including medicine, the music industry. They have now responded to God's call to serve their local communities as Christian leaders. The Bishop of Winchester ordained the new deacons following 2 or 3 years of training. As servant leaders, deacons take on the responsibility of serving their communities and reaching out to those in need. Deacons will usually be ordained to the priesthood the following year. Right Reverend Tim Dakin said, "It is a great privilege to ordain those whom God has called to serve the world and the church. The gifts that these individuals bring from their experiences in many walks of life will enrich the ministry they offer in the communities and make known the Christian faith in practical ways."
It's too late to change the sports centre plan. A review into Winchester's major projects is expected to be concluded within the next few weeks, the councillor leader has said. Councillor Lucille Thompson took over the role when the Liberal Democrats seized control of the City Council in May's local elections. Following their success, the party announced a review of the authority's major schemes that had previously been managed by the previous Conservative administration. It comes after Councillor Malcolm Prince, Cabinet Member for Sport, Leisure and Communities, said last week there would be no major changes to the new £38 million leisure centre. He said, "We have taken the time to review the plans for the Sport and Leisure Park, and there will be no major changes to the building, which would result in the project being delayed. However, we will be focusing on the internal layout to ensure the facilities meet the needs of all users." Now, Councillor Thompson has confirmed the centre's sports hall will not be increased from 8 courts in size to 12, a central criticism levelled by the Lib Dems before the election. She said, "Because of the financial cost of making the changes, now contracts have been signed and construction has begun on the Bar End facility, it is not possible to make the change." However, Councillor Thompson said they were looking at ways to improve sustainability and the wider park and reduce the facility's carbon footprint. Responding to the news, Winchester Sport, Art and Leisure Trust, SALT, whose chief executive, Emma Back, was one of the more vocal critics of the proposals, said, "We understand the new council administration would have liked a bigger sports hall at Bar End, and so would we, but it now seems it's too late to make this change affordably, which is a shame. The new facility will be great for swimming and other aquatic activities, but there's no doubt it's a missed opportunity in other respects. The architect focused on form over function, and the result is a building that's far more expensive than it needed to be. Hopefully, some internal changes can still be made so the facilities are easier to use. We look forward to seeing the results of the project review." Turning to the other major projects, Councillor Thompson said the Lib Dem administration was looking to put their footprint on the Silver Hill 2 project, now officially known as Saxon Gate, while praising the consultation under the Conservatives that led to its current state. The scheme aims to eventually regenerate a large portion of the city centre between Friarsgate and the Broadway. Meanwhile, she described the station approach scheme, which aims to regenerate the area around the railway station, as a much improved project compared to the original attempt, which collapsed due to criticism as to its size. Councillor Thompson said that part of the review was continuing and hoped to have it complete in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And that's accompanied by a photograph of Lucille Thompson, who is the new leader at the existing sports centre.
And now for some sport. This time it's women's cricket. The headline is "Hants Miss Out on Title." Hampshire women narrowly missed out on the first county T20 cup title in their history when they were beaten by Kent and Wales on a nervy final day in Aldershot. Hampshire, who were only promoted to the first division last season after winning the second tier, were top of the table going into the final two fixtures of the season. But an 8-run defeat in Kent and a humbling 6-wicket loss to Wales ended their hopes. Disappointed captain Katie George said, "It hurts a lot. We came into the weekend in a good position and we back ourselves, but on the day we didn't perform. The pitch deteriorated, but as batter we were too reactive and we didn't have a plan B. It's a young side and they're going to hurt, but they will learn from it and become better players next year and beyond." Let's hope so. This is accompanied by a photograph of the Hampshire Women's captain, Katie George, in full flight, about a whack a six, we hope.
Inspectors happy at NHS Trust. Staff at Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust have been praised for their hard work following a recent visit by the Care Quality Commission, CQC. The Trust, which runs Royal Hampshire County Hospital in Winchester and others in Andover and Basingstoke, has been recognised for the improvements that there have been made, which are supporting staff to provide the best possible patient care. CQC Deputy Chief Inspector of Hospitals, Dr. Nigel Aitchison, said, "Since our last inspection, Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust has worked incredibly hard to embed the improvements required as a result of our previous inspections, and I want to congratulate the Trust for what it has achieved. Our inspectors found a strong patient-centred culture with staff putting patients first to keep them safe and involving them in the decisions that affect their treatment and care." The CQC also acknowledged recent investments in the hospital buildings, which have resulted in positive impact on the experience of patients coming into the emergency departments at the hospitals in Basingstoke and Winchester. The new-look departments include purpose-built clinical space for children, ensuring that youngsters are seen away from other patients, and new assessment areas to ensure patients who arrive at hospital by ambulance can be quickly assessed and treated. Staff were praised for putting patients first, protecting their privacy and dignity, and ensuring that the health and safety of patients is effectively assessed. The Trust also recognised for improvements in the medicine safety, equipment maintenance, and its commitment to infection prevention and control. The reports also state that the Trust has met the requirements for improvements set out in the warning notice issued under Section 29A of the Health and Social Care Act 2008, following last year's full inspection. Alex Whitfield, Chief Executive of Hampshire Hospitals, said, "Staff at every level within our hospitals have worked incredibly hard to make improvements to their services and ensure our patients are receiving best possible care. So it's fantastic to see this hard work recognised by the CQC. We know there are still areas where we can make further improvements, and we'll continue to listen to our patients and staff to ensure we are delivering outstanding care to our local community. I would like to say a huge thank you to all the Hampshire Hospitals teams for all they do for our patients. Inspectors visit all three hospitals run by the Trust in April, and their reports, which are published on the July the 1st, can be read in full at www.cqc.org.uk.
And this is a local club. They miss their centenary year, and so they've just celebrated their 116th anniversary instead. Members of the Meon Valley Garden Club gathered at Meonstoke Hall to celebrate its 116th birthday with an afternoon tea organised by Leslie Lopez, the club's show secretary. A super time was had by the 80 members as they tapped into traditional fare with finger sandwiches, scones and clotted cream, and birthday cake washed down with a glass of fizz and the ubiquitous cups of tea. Two members, Stuart Attrill and Alan Hibbert, spent some months last year conducting research to ascertain when the club was established. They found a reference in a Hampshire Chronicle of 1904 reporting the second annual show of the Meon Valley Flower, Fruit and Vegetable Show. Having missed the opportunity to celebrate the 100th birthday, the committee decided it would be a good idea to hold an event to mark the ongoing success of such an old club. The afternoon tea included an exhibition of artefacts, some of which were recently presented to the current chairman, Olive Hathaway, by a former chair, Mr. Everett. Amongst them were show schedules going back to 1921 and minute books dated from 1930. They provided an insight into social history and how times have changed. In 1921, there was one class for women, and that was a bowl of cooked potatoes together with a class for, quote, ladies, for flower arranging. In 1950, the holder of the programme with the lucky number won a pig, and the runner-up a pair of nylon stockings. In 1991, John Martin, the committee member then and now, and club member for over 50 years, was in a local paper bemoaning that the club was likely to fold as there were only 80 members, and only a few willing to help on show day. It was about this time that the club decided to reinvent itself as a garden club, and today the club boasts a flourishing membership of over 200. The next event is the summer show to be held at the Meonstoke Hall on Sunday, the 21st of July, at 1:30 in the afternoon. In addition to the floral, vegetable and handicraft exhibits in the main hall, there are outside sideshows, games for the children, musical entertainment, and of course, teas, cakes and refreshments. And entry is only £1, with accompanied children free and ample parking. And this is accompanied by a couple of photographs. There's one which is obviously an extract from the Chronicle back in 1991, which has a lovely pun. Again, it shows, I suppose, Mr. Martin under the headline, "The Flower Show Wilts in a Wave of Apathy." And the second is a picture of a magnificent cake. So it looks really quite tasty as well. That is the 116th birthday cake for the tea celebration, and it's all been beautifully iced and looks quite magnificent with a bowl of flowers or a jug of flowers alongside it.
Next, we have the Hospital of St. Cross Fete for 2019, headlined Thousands Raised at Charity Fete. A charity event at a Winchester almshouse raised more than £10,500 for local charities as dozens of families gathered in the sunshine. The annual Hospital of St. Cross Fete saw around 2,000 people attend to browse the stalls and take part in activities. Southampton Society of Model Engineers were on hand to provide train rides across the field, and entertainment was provided by the Winchester Morris Men, the First Chandler's Ford Boys Brigade Band, and the Ukulele Band, and guests could also watch a traditional Punch and Judy show. Many flocked to the food area where teas, homemade cakes and ice cream were available throughout the day. The funds raised will be used to support the Parish of St. Faith, Go LD and Winchester Home Start. Well done them. Lots of money raised. It's accompanied by a number of photographs, including the Morris men in full splendour, dancing, bells round their knees and hankies at the ready. Also the model train taking children across the lawns. And the children watching the traditional Punch and Judy show. Great day was had by all.
And on a completely different note, County Wildlife Trust says, "We told you so." "We told you so," that's the hard-hitting message to Southern Water from Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust, which says it's been highlighting the devastating impacts of wastewater discharge for decades. The trust, which has 24,000 members, was speaking after the giant water firm, which deals with wastewater and sewage across Hampshire, has misreported the performance of a number of sewage treatment sites. Hampshire is home to some of the world's most important chalk streams, including the River Itchen, which is regarded as the home of fly fishing. Because Ofwat has not forced Southern Water to reveal where the sewage discharges occurred, it is not known if this river and the others in the area were affected. Regulator Ofwat also found the company manipulated its wastewater sampling process, and the company is now under criminal investigation by the Environmental Agency. In a statement, the Wildlife Trust said, "Wastewater discharge can contain a toxic cocktail of domestic, industrial and agricultural pollution, including hydrocarbons, heavy metals and chemicals like pesticides, as well as the nutrients from sewage systems. These pollutants contribute significantly to declines in freshwater and marine species such as salmon and the native crayfish, and can have knock-on impacts on humans through the shellfish that we eat, for example." Wildlife Trust executive Debbie Tan said, "Our chalk streams and coastal waters are amongst the most important and precious habitats for wildlife and are under untenable pressure. For decades, our rivers and seas have been polluted by wastewater discharges as well as runoff from the land. The Trust and other groups have long since highlighted the devastating impacts that these toxins can have on our wildlife and natural environment, decimating freshwater and marine species and jeopardising our natural resources. We have repeatedly called on water companies and other polluters to clean up their act." She said water companies had a responsibility and a vested interest to protect and enhance the environment and create a healthy and sustainable resource for both people and wildlife. "The trusts already work in partnership with Southern Water and other water companies to deliver practical improvements on our rivers and surrounding land, and we hope today's announcement will signal a real step change towards a better future." And there is a picture of a wintry River Itchen at Twyford. Trees are bare, and you can see actually quite clear water, which we are lucky to have around here.
Excuse me. Sorry. This is an article headed "Putting Hampshire on the World Map." Hampshire and its neighbours need to stop being so coy and tell the rest of the country how amazing they are. That was the message from an event which heard that the South needed the equivalent of the Northern powerhouse. The Regeneration South Conference also considered the idea that the region should become a national park city, thanks to the presence of the New Forest and South Downs National Parks. Robin Shepherd, partner at architect and planning firm Barton Willmore, said different parts of the region needed to come together rather than competing. He chaired a session at the Winchester event discussing the question, what is blocking investment in the South? He said, "I think there had been some growing frustration across the board that councils had perhaps not been as unified and they were in competition with each other and not perhaps seeing the bigger game so much, that the private sector was being failed. We took it upon ourselves to do something about it. We brought together the private and public sector and will hopefully stop talking about the Central South more and celebrating it and stop being so coy, stop being so shy about saying how amazing the place is." He said other parts of the UK would love to have the natural and man-made assets of the South, from its national parks to its universities. "It's always been the country's best-kept secret," he said. The conference was hosted by Business South, the social enterprise which champions the region's economy. It provided opportunities for potential investors, developers, agents, businesses and consultants to debate the future of the region. Mr. Shepherd said the conference had asked, "How do we put ourselves on the world map?" He added, "We're not competing with each other. It's not Southampton versus Portsmouth. with Bournemouth not able to decide whether it's part of the Central South or not. This is about us coming together and saying, we're about this and we are better unified than we are divided. The conference heard from Ben Smith, a trustee of National Park City, about how London had harnessed the potential of its parks. What he put out to the Central South was, do you want to be part of this, said Mr. Shepherd. We are quite close to London, and we've got two national parks. In terms of what we can offer people, that's a very direct link between lifestyle and environmental assets to what London has and doesn't have. He said the Central South could have a similar relationship with London to the one the Hamptons have with New York. We've got the lifestyle, we've got the marine and maritime, and we've got the national parks, he said. Other speakers included John Denham, the former Southampton Itchen MP, who now chairs the Southern Policy Centre. Mr. Shepherd said, Business South would now concentrate on working with partners to create a vision and strategy for growth. He said some were becoming a little resistant to growth and wanted to make sure that economic well-being was tied to good growth. The strategy would look at what people wanted the area to look like in 2050, he said. He believed the reorganisation of local government in Dorset, creating the new Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole Council along its southeast coast, would lead to the becoming more connected with Hampshire. I think there's a feeling that BCP is very much looking eastward towards this area, he said. And it's accompanied by a photograph of the speakers at the Regeneration South Conference at the University of Winchester.
Cash boost for dog search and rescue. Hampshire CERT search and rescue dogs have been awarded thousands of pounds in funding. Police and Crime Commissioner Michael Lane has awarded Hampshire Search and Rescue Dogs, HSRD, £6,401 in funding in order to purchase an incident support vehicle and safety equipment. The dog team provide nationally qualified search dog teams to support the police when looking for vulnerable missing people in Hampshire. They support the emergency services to save lives and keep Hampshire residents safe. Kev Saunders, Operation Officers for Hampshire Search and Rescue Dogs, said, "We're thrilled to receive this funding from the Police and Crime Commissioner. It allows us to buy our much-needed vehicle. Our team is entirely funded by donations, which enable us to continue with our life-saving work. Without these, we'd be unable to train and equip these amazing dogs and people or to provide such a vital voluntary service to the police. The vehicle will reduce their response time and help increase the chance of survival of a missing person. In addition to funding from the Police and Crime Commissioner, they have received grant awards from Hampshire County Council, Test Valley Borough Council and the National Lottery Community Fund. Hampshire Search and Rescue Dogs are called out by the police, the Coast Guards and other emergency services to search for missing vulnerable people." This is accompanied by a photograph of Kev Saunders with a search dog called Zach and another volunteer, Ali Orchard.
Thank you. That concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Margaret Boyd and Linda Vincent. And thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks to our readers, Tessa Hill.
Goodbye.
Norma York.
Goodbye.
And Andrew Parkinson.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye, and do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.